music from Dennis Jernigan, Matthew Ward, and Annie Herring together. When Night is Falling. And good morning to you. 62 degrees outside under sunny skies. It's a gorgeous day here in north central Minnesota. I'm Jim Park. David Allen Punn is with us, and Dr. Don joins us now from Garden Valley, Texas. It looks like sunshine down there, Don.
Oh, it's sunshine. We've been having the sun. There's no doubt about that.
Hot weather down there, huh?
Yep. It was over 100 pretty much every day last week. Oh. And it looks like we might be pushing that even this week.
Well, how are you holding up?
Well, it's actually been quite dry. And so things are starting to dry out, and I'm having to irrigate my vines a little bit more than usual.
Yeah, Dr. Don is a vintner. Is that the right word for that? A vintner?
I think a vintner actually makes wine, which I'll eventually get into, but I'm a grape grower.
A grape grower, okay.
That's the French would say, you are a vigneron.
Vigneron.
A vigneron.
V-I-G-E-R-O-N, I think it is.
Vigneron.
There's an extra N in there somewhere, but then usually after you say vigneron, you have to say,
Yeah, that's the way every sentence in French. Ends with that, yeah.
Right.
Mars is in the news. The Curiosity has landed. The first thing that struck David and I today is that what happened to names for these things? They used to be bold for things like Explorer and Apollo and Eagle, and now this is Curiosity. I kind of like the name, but I wonder if that's a change in attitude on the part of scientists.
Well, that's interesting. I don't know. I mean, it's I guess the name, you know, probably came from, well, we're curious about what substances there are on Mars.
Well, I like the name. I mean, it's a genteel sort of name compared to what they use. But I'm wondering if it reflects a little bit of public attitude towards space exploration. You know, we're not nearly as gung-ho about it as we used to be. Now it's kind of a commercial thing and a purely scientific thing, not so much a public effort.
Yeah, well, it seems that way. And since, you know, man isn't going anywhere, at least not leaving this planet again, I don't think the public is not only not aware of what's going on, but NASA probably hasn't. I mean, they have a beautiful website, but I don't know if they've, you know, it's not in the news like it obviously was when we were going to the moon.
You know, I remember in the 60s watching those early morning launches with Walter Cronkite and Huntley and Brinkley on the other channel and getting all excited about those things. It's just a different thing now. There's other scientific news, though, and this broke on the BBC. David found this article Thursday or Friday. And apparently scientists in Antarctica have been drilling down on the edges of the continent. And they've come up with evidence that indicates or proves, this says, that palm trees grew there, not to mention other tropical and subtropical plants and life forms. What do you think of that? And of course, their time frame, it's millions and millions of years ago, but how could this be, Don? Are they right in terms of what they found? We can't deny the findings, can we?
No, I don't think we can deny the findings. I mean, what they found was actually pollen of various trees and then some microorganisms as well. And so they're actually palm trees and I think some other type of trees.
Well, they said baobab, which I think grows in Africa these days, and macadamia, which I think the only place they grow naturally is Australia. But macadamias have been exported to other parts of the world, most notably Hawaii. But it's still a warm weather, a subtropical kind of tree. So,
right. So how can this be? I mean, you know, you look at it and say, wow, that's interesting. A continent that is now completely covered in ice. How could it have been, you know, subtropic temperatures at one point in our past history? Now, they are postulating that it's due to, well, sometime in the past, the CO2 levels must have been tremendously high, and therefore we had this canopy of CO2, and we had the greenhouse effect, and that's why, there were trees growing there.
And well, that's a theory. That's kind of guesswork, isn't it? I mean, figuring out why these things were there.
Yeah, exactly. Oh. Exactly. That is completely completely guesswork. There's really no, you know, no science behind it. They're even kind of using computer models to say, well, if we have this much CO2 in the air, then the temperature is going to be this over the planet. Those models have proven to be wrong in the past. So you have to ask yourself, okay, what does the Bible say about this? Mm-hmm. Yeah, does the Bible say anything about this? And if you go back to Genesis, you will find that, well, at one point in time, and we talked about continents adrift, one point in time, the Bible describes, you know, kind of one landmass.
Yes, it does. I mean, there was a what they would call a supercontinent.
Right. And that apparently existed at the time of Adam and Eve, and didn't start probably breaking up until the flood in Noah's days. And so if that's true, that landmass was probably in a tropic, subtropic environment.
The landmass, just kind of backing up. So Antarctica is a continent. It's a landmass. The Arctic is ocean. Is that correct? I mean, it's not
the Arctic?
Not land under the North Pole. I think that's all ocean and ice, as I recall. But the South Pole is in Antarctica,
yeah,
which is a continent, a land continent, which at one time then was farther north than it is now.
Right, and it was one of the pieces that broke up when the continent started to break up. It was, you know, more than likely after the flood. Not before the flood, because the flood actually... It wasn't just rain that came down. You had all kinds of volcanic activity and all kinds of movement of the Earth at the time. And, the Earth could move apart very, very quickly and not, you know, take millions and millions and millions of years that, you know, most folks think that it probably took, because if you measure it today, the movement isn't that fast. So if you try to extrapolate that back in time, yes, of course, it's going to take millions of years. But when the when things are changing very, very, very rapidly, as they were at the time of the flood, then you're going to have land masses that, you know, can move apart pretty quickly and take some time to settle down. But climate change, a lot of volcanic activity sending up dust particles in the air, which then, you know, block the sun, which then causes an ice age in various places, and so we can explain a lot of things based on the events that happened kind of immediately. I'm saying within the first 700 years after the flood, for example.
So the continents then, and of course Genesis says that God was using this as a way of cleansing the earth of evil man in particular, and it's kind of like rebooting. I mean, it has that same feel, like, well, I want to get back to where we were, and so God, in essence, it sounds like remade the earth, reshaped it anyway.
Yeah, he did, and he made it, and it's an interesting, you know, from a spiritual point of view, and it's an interesting concept, because here's God basically says, Noah, take yourself and your immediate family, and I believe God would have taken more people into the ark had they repented, and because Noah had 120 years to preach to them. Mm-hmm. What he was doing and why, you know, why he was doing it, but people ignored him, and it was probably. And I can just imagine people just scoffing at him, you know, as being a lunatic. It'd be like today if you started, you know, in your, it'd take a little bit bigger than a backyard, but started building a huge boat or even a huge rocket ship to take you somewhere, because you know that the Earth is going to blow up. because God told you, people would say that you're nuts.
Well, looking at this from an even large, you know, we go up to 50,000 feet here instead of 10,000 feet. Does this mean God changed his mind?
Oh, no, I don't think God changed. God knew from the very beginning because he knew even before he created Adam that he would have to send the second Adam.
Mm-hmm.
And he had that, you know, kind of all planned out. I think we can alter the timing a little bit by our obedience or disobedience. The more we disobey, I think the timing gets rushed, and the more we obey, you know, God kind of holds his
That's an issue of grace. Stance. That's where grace comes in, correct?
That's right. And you know, with the breaking up of the, you know, why did God have to break up the continents, for example? That's an interesting question, because if you have evil man, and even though there were only eight people that you know survived the flood and were on the ark, you still had there was Noah, and he was a righteous man, and Shem, and but you know Japheth, you know, but it didn't take long before man started to be corrupt again. And so if you have a corrupt man, the best thing that you can do is kind of isolate the populations and, you know, spread them out really around the world. And then you can survive longer. Because if you get too many people that are evil in one place, they're going to have a tendency to wipe themselves out,
as we've seen over history
yeah. with wars and wars and wars.
I'm thinking of the Tower of Babel. That was one thing that that resulted from evil man congregating in large numbers in one place, and he took specific action then. But Genesis does tell us that the sons of Noah went off in different directions and were responsible for the populations in different geographic areas.
That's correct. And so, I mean, they were populating the earth, but then by the, and of course there, you know, there had to be a land bridge to get over to the Americas, for example, you know, at some point in time. And, you know, I think it was pretty early on when people started to multiply after they started to fill the earth again.
Mm-hmm.
But you had people migrating, fortunately, all over the earth. And God's command to Adam and Eve was in the very beginning, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. You know, don't just stay in one place. Don't just create a big city for yourself or a big tower, but actually fill the earth. And so God designed it so that, you know, the earth could be farmed, and the earth could be, he told Adam also after the fall, you know, so he said, by the sweat of your brow, you shall fill the earth. I mean, you shall eat.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, working hard, tilling the soil. It was kind of an agrarian, you know, type of system. That God was saying, this is how you're going to live from now on. You're just not going to pick fruit off the trees.
Let's do a little more theological speculating here. What I'm hearing from you is that the separation of the continents and the flood, the whole Noah episode, was really maybe the first step in preparing for the second Adam. And that perhaps this was a way to isolate or to give birth to the population, the people that would later become the Israelites, which is the nation that God had chosen to work through. So this was all part of that plan. I mean, it's easy to say yes, but do you see a pattern there?
Well, yeah, I think not only was it part of God's plan, because he, again, you know, he wasn't surprised by anything. And so for him to say, you know, that the Shemites, mm-hmm. the descendants of Shem, were going to become ultimately the Israelites, at least, you know, some of their descendants, and they were the ones that actually kind of stayed in the area, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't go roaming off into the North Country, which is now, you know, Europe and Russia, and over to the Americas, or south down into you know, Africa, for example, the African continent, or far east. But they stayed in the general area, and God used the people that stayed there.
And there is something to the idea that this is a fertile crescent. This is kind of the nucleus of civilization, the Eastern Mediterranean, and in what is now Afghanistan and Iran and Iraq and Syria and Jordan and Israel. So much history has been centered there, and will be again if you read ahead.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the Bible. I mean, that's
yes,
that's
of course Jesus is going to return mm-hmm. to the Mount of Olives. So mm-hmm. there's continued history there, and it is the kind of the I wouldn't necessarily say it's the birthplace of man. You know, where was that brings up the question is where was the Garden of Eden? You know, my guess would be that it'd have to be in that area. You know, it was.
Well, there's some evidence that I've seen that some evidence, because supposedly four rivers ran from the site, and I'm told that now with satellite photography, they've actually spotted two additional dry riverbeds that could comprise mm-hmm. the third and fourth rivers. And now the speculation is, for those that are concerned with this, that the Garden of Eden may now be underwater, actually be at the northern tip of the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, because that's where these four rivers apparently actually didn't come together. It wasn't the confluence of the four rivers, but four rivers were present, flowing in different directions.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's one possibility. But the notion that you know, we read the Bible, and for us now, it's broken up into chapters and verses. And it's so easily segmented, Old Testament, New Testament, then book by book by book, and the story changes. But if you step back and take a look at the whole thing, it's really a continuum of one elegant and eternal strategy to redeem mankind.
Yeah, that's right. And it's when you look at it from that perspective, or when you see things in the Bible that just completely do not make sense. I mean, take the Battle of Jericho, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, go walk around the city, you know, 7 days, once every 7 days, and then on the seventh day, walk around it seven times, and then blow your trumpets. I mean, why? You know, God could have just said, okay, I'll just knock the walls down, you go in, and you take care of the
people. I just hear Joshua's sub-lieutenant saying, say again?
What is this? And Joshua was like, that's okay. We've seen this before. You know, we just obey. That's
just,
all God,
just
that's
do it. Just do it, guys. Okay.
We don't understand. But if you look at that in the context of, you know, world history and what is going to happen at the end times, of course, we know that, you know, from reading Revelation, that there is a final trump in which, you know, God... Jesus comes back, and you know, a lot of people get wiped out, and a lot of people get, you know, are saved. But you know, it there is this crescendo to our present civilization, if you will, or the world mm-hmm. that we lived in. There is a crescendo, and it looks pretty much like what happened in Jericho. So God does these things. He gives us little hints. He has these little symbols
pattern,
in the Bible.
Patterns and types and foreshadowing all through the Bible. That's one of the most fascinating aspects of Scripture to me. Because you can read the details of a story that makes sense in human terms for that time and that place, but there's always, almost always, a larger sense, a pattern that develops from that explains something on a much larger scale at the same time. And you could say, well, that's just the way we look at it. That's the way our minds work. Or you could look at it from the other end of the telescope and say God intended us to teach us, for us to learn from these examples and apply them on a larger scale. So, but there's nothing in this article then in terms of the basics. That is, they found palm trees in Antarctica and primitive life forms and pollen from other kinds of plants that are subtropical. There's nothing in that part of it that conflicts. The part that says it happened 23 million years ago would be in conflict with the young Earth philosophy, and the idea that it was caused by excessive CO2 in the atmosphere is purely guesswork, what we're saying.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, okay. I mean, if you have, I can imagine that there was probably, conjecturing that the change in, the temperature, making it a subtropic, environment, being caused by, CO2, as opposed to, this continent was further, further north.
Yeah, they seem to talk about part of a about two causative effects here. They don't talk about how it would be one over the other, at least in this BBC article. So there may be more to it when you'd actually talk to the people involved. But that was an interesting thing about the article. One possibility, CO2. The other possible was simply continental drift.
Yeah, no, that's right. And so I think, the continental drift story is probably more applicable here and fits more in with the Bible's description of how early, what early Earth looked like. And, subsequently, like I said, to the flood, but to jump on this CO2 story,
the global warming
again,
aspect,
and global warming, I think is it's kind of adding fuel to the fire, and it comes out of the scientific realm. Here's what we know, into a more much speculative, almost political agenda.
Well, been made political. And speaking of drifting, David hasn't said a word yet here, but now we're getting into David's territory here. How global warming has become a political football.
Well, yeah, it has. The I guess I'm not sure exactly what you're looking for me to say. It has become almost a religion on its own.
There is another comment on Yahoo News about another one of the proponents of global warming saying, "See, I told you so." And he's referring to the heat waves that have hit in Europe and the 2010 heat wave in Russia, and he's saying, "See," but then they do qualify it by saying, "Well, he's an activist too for the cause." He's caught up in that.
One of the things that I've always reflected about global warming activists is that they always say it's going warm, but never say anything about when it gets really cold. I mean, we had cold snaps last year, and nobody mentioned a thing. Nobody brought it up. No, none of the global warming says, "Well, it's cold, but it's okay; it'll get warm again."
Although I have heard the theory that we're seeing simply more extremes as a result of this, because the weather patterns are pretty complex. Weather patterns are changing, whether it's for hotter, but they're always changing, and I'm thinking there are cycles been going on since the beginning.
Yeah, the cycles have been going on since the beginning, and these are all based on computer models that are highly suspect, that anybody's guesswork is involved. And the media tends to be very complicit in this particular area of selling the man-made global warming theory, but not even suggesting alternatives.
Well, why is global warming a cause for liberals and a cause for conservatives is denying it?
Denying that
it's warming? How did it get to be political?
Because there's money involved.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And it's your tax money and Don's tax money and my tax money. That's where it comes down to. Michael Crichton wrote a book, a fictionalized account, just before he died. I think it was like his, second to the last book, called The State of Fear, and he suggested in it that there was a global wide network of activists who were drumming up global warming fears primarily to get tax dollars and grants,
research grants,
and make millions of dollars from all kinds of, of all kinds of studies and researches and all the rest of it. I mean, none of this research takes place in somebody's garage at somebody's own behest. He doesn't do anything, and the scientist doesn't do anything unless he gets a grant.
Although I have been keeping track of my air conditioning bill over the years. Yeah, I guess that counts.
You're doing that in your own?
Counts as research, oh yeah.
Are you?
Yeah.
You should apply for a grant.
to analyze the data. I mean, you could get a new computer.
Yeah, I could do that.
Right. Yeah.
Come they'll to think of it, I could capitalize on this thing too.
They'll send
never
you money
to me.
Yes.
So yeah, let's go back to the question though: is why, especially with this, you know, the CO2 story, and that has to do with is man responsible for the Earth warming up? Is there something that we can do to cause the Earth warm up? And, of course, the proponents of global warming are saying, well, absolutely. You see all this fossil fuel that we're burning? It's causing an increase of CO2, and that's what's causing, you know, global warming. Well, in reality, CO2 has very little effect on the temperature of the Earth. I mean, because it gets absorbed into the oceans quite readily, and over a period of time, more CO2 you have in the air, the more vegetation you're going to have, because the trees and obviously green things use CO2 for food, and so and convert it into sugars and plant structures and things like that. So it's kind of a self-regulating mechanism. So CO2 in itself is not going to cause the Earth temperature to rise very much, but it does allow politicians to say, well, here's a way we can tax and distribute wealth. Mm-hmm. Because who's the biggest offender of fossil fuel use right at the moment? It's United States. Now, China is catching up very rapidly as they produce more, you know, vehicles, of course, and more industry. But if we can use this excuse to tax the United States and redistribute wealth, then we can get to a global government a lot faster than if we don't have a mechanism like this.
Hmm. Pernicious.
Yep. It's all about...
I haven't used that word all day, but there it is.
You got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's about those that don't have would like to have, and that's one way to get it.
By the way...
Well, and it's not necessarily that they get it, because it's the politicians and it's the leaders that say, if I can get more control, if I can get more money, I've got more control.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so any mechanism that I can use to suck more money out of people or out of industry, I'm going to do that, because that will give me more control.
And also you create another little blip in my brain here when you talked about man accusing man of being big enough, significant enough, careless enough to affect the global climate. It's almost a humanist viewpoint that says man is in charge here. Man is able to build or destroy, to improve or to degrade his environment. And I think we're all aware of the fact that we've been commissioned as stewards of the Earth and need to take care of it. But to think that it's up to us whether it succeeds or fails, lives or dies, might be assuming too much.
Yeah, I think it is assuming. This Earth was designed, I mean, just like our human bodies are designed to come into homeostasis once it gets out of homeostasis, and what I mean by that, to come into balance chemically. Mm-hmm. You know, if for some reason we come out of balance, like, you know, we go outside, and especially here in Texas, you work too hard and you get too much sun, you get a little bit of heat exhaustion. Come back in, you know, pump yourself with a little electrolytes, and pretty soon your body comes back into normal temperature because it's got the nutrients and everything that it, you know, and the water that it needs to replenish itself. The Earth is the same way. I mean, you push things over to one side, and a good example of this is what happened after Mount St. Helens, when half of a mountain blew away. Lake down at the bottom of the mountain, you know, thousands if not millions of trees, you know, wound up in the lake, and the landscape was completely stripped of any, you know, trees or any life. And you look at it today and you say, wow, look, there's trees growing. there's this growing. There's animals are coming back into the area. We've got the lake is coming back to life. So the earth has a tremendous ability to kind of repair itself. Now, it doesn't happen overnight, but it doesn't take millions and millions of years either.
Well, of course, they were speculating after Mount St. Helens that it would be generations before it could return to anything approaching normal. But it's been, 25 years, something like that?
Yeah, I was in the 80s, and so, yeah, it's, 25, 30 years, and here we are. The life is coming back to the area.
You know, Dr. Don, we know you so well. I was remiss in not introducing you as a biochemist and now vice chairman of the board of creationmoments.com. Congratulations are in order, I take it?
Oh, no, I've been vice chairman for actually quite some time.
Oh, I did. Well, I knew you were on the board. I didn't know you were the vice chairman. Of course, the real power lies with the secretary. We all know that.
Yeah, because they have the ability to sign things or not to sign things.
and put down in the minutes what they think should be there. And, that's where the seat of power is. But, no, congratulations. It's a valuable ministry. By the way, I want to let people know that you can visit Creation Moments just by clicking on the link on our webpage, brokenroadradio.com. Over to the right is a link to Creation Moments, and you'll find a wealth of resources there for your own personal study, or for maybe church materials and other ministry applications for... Hey, we've got videos. What else is over there, Dr. Don?
Well, they can DVDs. Download... Yeah. They can have either as a podcast or a download off the website the Creation Moment of the Day or past Creation Moments. We have a smartphone app that is available on, for example, iTunes that you can... you can download and listen to our Creation Moments, that way. It doesn't necessarily have to be on your radio station. Mm-hmm. So,
and you blog there as well, don't you?
I do.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, from time to time. I've been extremely busy with the vineyard, so I haven't been able to set aside some time for writing, but I will be getting back to that soon.
Well, Creation Moments.
And we have transcripts of the Creation Moments. Mm-hmm. We have, of course, a bookstore and online bookstore where we've got tons of resources. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a valuable ministry, and we're just really thrilled that you can be a part of what we do here on Broken Road Radio. We get to talk to Dr. Don just about every Monday morning. And he enlightens us. Conversations usually center on science versus faith, creation versus evolution, and similar topics. And anything of scientific knowledge, we just get Dr. Don on it, and we learn a whole lot. So this is a valuable time every Monday morning on the Broken Road. Don, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It's always my pleasure.
Well, survive. Hey, David, any last thoughts? You always get the last thought.
No, I think we covered it pretty well today.
I think we did.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, the palm trees in Antarctica. And maybe in the coming weeks, of course, the topics change every week, but we can take a look at, hopefully we'll get some data back from Curiosity now sitting on the surface of Mars and looking for the ingredients of life. I guess that would mean things like amino acids and little proteins and little bugs and stuff. I don't know what all that includes.
I did just happen to think of one thing about the palm trees. The same author, I believe, Michael Crichton, wrote a book years ago about the belief that every 1,500 years, 15 to 5,000 years, the Earth would shift its polar axis.
Yeah, I've heard that theory too.
And that was, and the book was a fiction account of people getting ready to move north or move south, depending upon which way they were headed. But I mean, the Earth it would shift so quickly there was no time to move.
Yeah, it would be a cataclysmic event, and with a shorter cycle time. Although I had read where some scientific evidence exists that it's about every 10,000 years, and it's due to happen again, and it has to do with the weight of the polar ice caps and reestablishing equilibrium. It's kind of a tilt of the axis, so. Lots of areas where we can go in future weeks, Dr. Don. So fasten your seatbelt.
Okay. Sounds like a lot of fun. So.
Oh, yeah.
Don, have a terrific week. And we're headed back to music on a Broken Road Radio Monday morning. This is music from River.